News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Each week we visit with World War II veterans, and the idea is pretty simple. First of all, we want to honor them for their service and their sacrifice, realizing that we wouldn't have the freedom we enjoy in this country today without their efforts. We also want to preserve their stories for posterity and maybe along the way learn a thing or two, be inspired to love our country the way they have. Leo Weil has loved his country for a long time. He's going to be 90 this December. He's not quite to 90 yet, so we'll call him 89 years old for the duration of the show today. And normally I start the show on December 7th, 1941, but I can't do that this week because you were actually in the service before then. How did you end up in the Army Air Corps in 1940?
I joined.
You wanted to go.
Absolutely. I wanted to go. And I thought I would try out to be a pilot, but did work that way. I joined at Mitchell Field, Long Island. Did I say Long Island?
Well, you are a New Yorker. You can say it however you want.
And they formed a new outfit from one group. There were very few fighter groups in the United States then, and they all had P-40s, which was a real tough airplane. Anyway, after I was at Mitchell Field a while, they sent me to school in Chicago. It was a college for airplane and engine mechanics. I was there 9 months, and we graduated and went back to our outfit. When I got back, I was looking for some friends. They said, well, while you're away, a group of generals came to the outfit. They lined everybody up, the whole squadron, each squadron. There was three squadrons with mechanics and airplanes. And they said, you men are going to volunteer. So they really didn't know what was happening to them. Every third man volunteered.
Involuntarily.
Involuntarily. And that started the Flying Tigers in China. And they had to get a discharge from the Army Air Corps. It was false or whatever they did, but they were discharged. And they went to China to fight the Japanese.
So that was the American volunteer group with General Chenault flying P-40s in China against the Japanese.
Right. That happened before the war started with the United States. Anyway, we were doing maneuvers in Long Island. Then we heard about Pearl Harbor. Right after that, we went back to Mitchell Field.
Well, let me interrupt. You say you heard about Pearl Harbor. Take me back to that day, because that's one thing we explore every week on this show. It seemed to have an impact on everyone, no matter if they were old enough to serve or not. They remember that day. They remember how they heard. They remember the impact that it had on them then. What did it mean to you as someone who's already in the Army Air Corps?
I don't want to be obnoxious to anybody, but I felt very unhappy about our generals who did not do their duty. In the Air Corps, if you're in a zone where there may be trouble, there's always our planes up circling to make sure they're not surprised. It happened on a Sunday, and usually anybody to get a hold of liquor would be drunk till Monday. And that's the truth, and I hate to insult people that way, but that's how I felt. It was a shame that all these men were killed unnecessarily because nobody was watching.
So you felt like any surprise attack was really inexcusable because they should have seen it coming.
I think so. That's my opinion.
Well, sure, and you're entitled to it. Did that news motivate you to get out there and do something? Did it have any bearing on your mentality or your ambition to participate? Did that news motivate you to get out there and do something? Did it have any bearing on your mentality or your ambition to participate?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We had joined to stop Hitler and the Japanese. Our outfit was sent after Pearl Harbor. They were sent to the West Coast to help protect Seattle and California. And they thought that the Japanese were approaching. And we had two groups that went out there. I don't know what you could do with two groups. Three squadrons each group. We just didn't have it. You know, before the war, we had a Congress that didn't believe in war. They thought sitting in Long Island and sitting any place in the state, they're safe. Everybody's safe. But, of course, they were found to be false. Nobody's safe in a general war like we had.
And a lot of people don't realize this because we think of World War II and we think about the huge bomber squadrons and the fighters that would come in during the war, like the P-47s and the P-51s. But at this point, when the war is just getting started, the resources that America had at its disposal were pretty slim. And it sounds like you were pretty familiar with that.
Yes. When I joined, it took 6 weeks for me to get a uniform. They didn't have any. No guns. And we lived through it, but it wasn't a real army. And if you read that book by Atkinson about the invasion of North Africa by the Americans, according to his book, it helped end the war. It was very important. People say, North Africa, that's nothing, you know. But it was something, because there weren't many German troops in that whole area, in the Mediterranean. Hitler had to send thousands of his troops from Russian front to come to and try to recapture North Africa from the Americans mostly and the British. So the war started for America on the European area with the landing in Morocco and a couple of more landings. That was the first time the Americans in this theater ever fired a shot.
And a lot of people think it started on June 6, 1944, but they'd be ignoring a lot of your personal history if that were the case. And you talked about your ambition to be a pilot, but for our listeners' sake, explain what you were doing. You were still involved in aircraft, still a key piece to the organization that you were in with the 58th Pursuit Squadron of the 33rd Fighter Group. What were your responsibilities?
Well, I became a crew chief, and a crew chief for a fighter plane is one person, and all the auxiliary people, the people who took care of the guns and the ammunition, radio people, all services, people who supply the gasoline, were auxiliary to the crew chief. And there was only one crew chief to each plane. We had to take care of the plane.
And that's a pretty big responsibility, because there are lives that are at stake with that position.
Absolutely. You know, that's why we never, in our outfit, we never saluted anybody unless some general came around. We were all friends. We ate together. We were very friendly, and we knew our job, and they knew that, because without the crew chief, they have nothing.
So tell me about your first taste of war, when you got to the area where you knew things were going to get a little hairy, and how those experiences impacted you.
They sent us down to Norfolk, Virginia, to train new pilots. They'd get their basic training, but, you know, for gunnery and all the various thing a pilot had to do. We were in Norfolk. When we got down there, it was the winter time. There was no place for us to sleep. So the city said, we just finished a prison near the airport. So there were pots with stoves. They had about four stoves at each barracks. And that's where we were, the prison farm. And our planes came in, and we started training B-40s. Our group was formed from the only group that was in Mitchell Field, Long Island. So they split off one, and that became the 33rd group. They formed the greatest armada of ships for an invasion. We went on a banana boat with the Rangers. It was our squadron, and the Rangers were on that boat. Very small capacity. And as we got out to join the armada, the Rangers told, you boys will be happy. The whole bottom of this boat is full of munitions. So, and it was.
So you were a floating bomb, basically, is what you're saying.
Well, everybody was. It took 24 days in that armada to cross the ocean with submarines. God, now we used to watch for submarines all day long. We all got sick on board, and that was part of it. Nobody shot at an enemy in their lives, and we're going to invade North Africa. That was pretty good hope. Anyway, we were moved. Our motto was split up. I think it was four different places. We were at Port Leote. That was our invasion. The only reason we were there was, well, the city of Port Leote is a pretty large city, had a cement runway, and our airplanes were on a carrier. And as soon as we would capture the airport, they would fly to the airport they had captured. The invasion started in the morning, and all those boats were the landing craft boats, and they were going down the ropes into them, and everything was chaos. And they had to land at this beach. The beach was a beach that had little homes for vacations. And we're waiting on board and we're looking out to see what happened. You know, they'd be running all these soldiers in these little boats. The next morning, they told us all to assemble with all our things. They're not having very good luck on the invasion, and they need you. So we were thinking, what are we to do? We're not soldiers. I mean, we're mechanics. Well, anyway, we had to. They said, down these ropes. We never went down a rope into the landing barges. Anyway, we landed, and we dug in. We had a captain with us. It was a reserve captain. He wasn't in the Air Force, but he was with the ground people. He had orders for us to go opposite the fort, and that's your position from now, because we don't have enough men to protect the town. And that's where everything was working. So we marched, and they had given us Tommy guns.
So you've basically gone from aircraft mechanic to infantryman overnight.
Right. We had slept in town in the little homes, on tables, wherever we could. And the call to arms the next morning, because there was a squad of French troops who had left the fort, and they, you know, to go out and see what's happening. So we laid there, and one guy started shooting. We all were shooting, having a good time shooting, scared as hell. But anyway, we drove him back, and I fired my Tommy gun for the first time, and all of us did, against the enemy. You know, I was just at a deal in Sacramento when they sang the Americans' song, and the fort was still there or something. Well, when we were on the beach, we were fighting the French and right. All their allies, the African allies, and their flag was there. We just watched. That was the next day after we were shooting. Then the flag wasn't there, and our flag, the American flag, was up there. So they had gone to the fort, the 9th Division, I think they were, and they captured the fort. Then all of a sudden, there was a French flag up there because the French recaptured it. Every time I hear that song, I can remember that. Here we are with the flag down and the flag up.
So anytime you're at a sporting event or watching one on TV and they play the Star Spangled Banner, you think of North Africa.
Absolutely. Okay, then we finally captured the fort. I should get back and tell you why the Rangers were with us. There was a river leading on the side of that little town. The ship we were on was supposed to break through the... They had all kinds of ropes and all kinds of things to not allow anybody through. And they were supposed to go up the river, which was right at the airport, and capture that for the mechanics, with our people, for the mechanics, with our people, to get there, and our planes would fly in. Well, they couldn't do that because the French still had the fort and the Rangers couldn't get through the wire and all that up the river. So the Rangers had to go someplace else. Finally, the next day, the boat I was in, it was a very flat bottom one, the one that carried bananas, and they finally went through to the river. They started to go up the river and they had to stop because they couldn't get through even with the flat bottom. So we started walking from the beach all along the river, and we had to stop a lot of times because we had our tools, everything with us. We saw all kinds of dead people along the way. They weren't our, I mean, they were the French and their allies. And that's the first time we ever saw these things. You know, we were a little scared.
That's the question that strikes me, is what did that do to you as a guy who's 20 years old and seeing all this and experiencing this for the first time? How did you process that? How did you handle it and wake up the next morning actually wanting to do something?
We knew what we had to do. We were all enlisted people. We had no people from the draft in our outfit, in most outfits at that time. So everybody expected something to happen. We were afraid, but we weren't that much afraid. We were, you know, we were in American forces, and we figured the guys up in there fighting knew what they were doing. Everybody knew what they're doing, but everything was chaos.
You weren't rattled when all of a sudden they're giving you a gun you've never fired before, and oh, by the way, they're firing at you too?
We were okay, really. I didn't see anybody crying. The only one I saw crying, and I hope he does, his family isn't around, is this captain from the reserve that took care of the ground personnel. And he used to command us all over the place before we got on the boats. I and this other fellow find them in headquarters looking for food. and he was sitting in a corner with his head between his legs. I said, what happened to him? He says, we got to send him back to the States. He can't take it. But we were young people. He was an older man.
Well, and that was not uncommon or infrequent at the time.
Anyway, we finally got to the hangar, and it's getting late, and we went to sleep. There was no action there yet. And during the night, we were all sleeping. Then we heard somebody in the hangar yelled out to us softly, get up, get out, and lie down. So we got up, we took our guns, we went outside the hangar, and there was a road coming down, and there were lights coming toward the hangar. And everybody was excited. Oh, who's coming? So we laid there, and they got closer and closer. One of the guys in there says, when we tell you, just shoot. We thought it's the enemy coming to take the hangar back. People all excited, but I thought, geez, why do that? And, you know, in war, there's always passwords. So I shouted out the password, and somebody from the car shouted back there, whatever they're supposed to say, and everybody relaxed. Nobody knows about that because nobody knew who shouted. I didn't tell them, and I felt like I saved a lot of lives, and there could have been generals in that, or maybe General Clark was there coming to inspect the hangar. I don't know. We don't know. They sent us back to the to go back to sleep.
So you're asleep in this hangar that you guys have finally captured and are occupying, and someone whispers that lights are approaching, and they have everyone at the ready to fire on the command. And so what possessed you, instead of just following orders and having your gun ready and firing, to actually yell out the password?
Well, they gave us a password, and I had to use it because there are soldiers around. You don't know who's around, and you're supposed to use the password. You've heard that and seen there many movies about the war. So that's what I did, and I felt that I had to do it. And it worked.
But if they had had the wrong answer, you would have been shooting.
Right, absolutely. But they called it the right answer. And I don't know who was in it. And we went back. You know, they tell you to go back, you go back. It's none of our business. You know, people in any war don't know what's happening. You don't know what's happening down the block. All you know is where you are and who your enemy is. And that is all through the 2 years I was overseas. We never knew who was next door. Nobody told you, and they said, it's none of your business, so.
Well, I can tell you what's next. A quick message from some of our sponsors. But when we come back, more of the unique story of 89-year-old Leo Weil of Fresno. There aren't too many veterans of the North African campaign around anymore. You've already heard about some of those early days of World War II, and you'll hear more as Hometown Heroes comes right back on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom. You are listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation this week with 89-year-old Leo Weil of Fresno, California, originally from the Bronx, New York. But in November of 1942, he was in Morocco with the 33rd Fighter Group. He's told us about the landing at Port Leote up the coast from Casablanca and Rabat, and how he went from aircraft mechanic to infantryman as the Allied forces wrestled control of the city away from the Vichy French. He has many more stories to share with us, but Leo, as I understand it, it almost ended right there on the beach for you, and you would have had no one to blame but yourself.
When we landed on the beach, they thought I got killed. Why? Well, I figured the butt of the gun, you know, is down is the best thing, because where you fire through, the sand would get in there and be wasted, liable to explode in your hand. So I was lying down, and I hit the butt of the gun I was had. And it fired. It went right past me, and I got scared. I went down, and I hear somebody yelling, get the nade! Weil was hit. They all thought I was hit, but luckily I wasn't.
Well, that would have been a really disappointing ending of this story if you wounded yourself and ended your own war right off the bat.
After the hangar incident, our planes came in. They lost one they never found, and they flew into our field during the invasion. There were big guns, warships and destroyers and all kinds of ships that were assigned to our beach. And they were shooting, and they put all kinds of holes in the runway. So we lost a lot of planes coming in. Luckily, that nobody got killed. They'd be going, boom, there's another hole and all that stuff. What can I tell you? Oh, that's when I got malaria. No, that wasn't fun. the Navy set up a small hospital, and they sent me and about three other fellows from our outfit had gotten malaria. They had beds there. There was nothing except quinine. The new drug for malaria hadn't been out yet. So I had up to 105 temperature in that little place, and everybody was in the same boat. And this Navy fellow came in. He says, you know, we see a Pantone naval ship flying in here. So we're all sitting with our fingers crossed. Sure enough, they found quinine in one of the islands that the Japanese had not taken over. They found some quinine. They rushed us with it. And then our planes did a few missions where we were. They bombed some French town where the French were, and they shut down some French planes. After we were in the hospital getting better, this guy comes down with a truck. He said, we're moving. We're going to Algeria. What? You gonna leave us here? Oh, no, no. We have a 48 boxcar, and we have a boxcar for you, the people that are sick, and we have a corpsman who will stay with you. We got into that little thing, and we started a long trip across North Africa, and we'd stop and get water. We'd rush into town and get a beer or get some whiskey, whatever guys wanted. The little towns along there never knew there was a war on. We'd come in, Americans, what do you do here, you know? We were strafed many times. We got through okay. Nobody was killed. Anyway, we finally got to where we were supposed to go. It wasn't Tunisia, it was the passing pass was Tunisia, and next to it was Algeria. So that's where we found we have to stay in this field. It was no picnic. They never put down iron or anything. They didn't have the supplies. And that's where they landed, and they did well because it's a hard surface. So, you know, we had planes out there and Germans out there. There was a colonel, famous colonel, has his own story I have here, who was with the 101st Airborne, Colonel Raff, R-A-F-F, and he was in charge of this little group who came to save us from the Germans flying and strafing us all the time. So he came with a group. What they did, it was very interesting. At the edge of the mountain, there was a road. It was paved, or some of it wasn't. And Raff, he got some French trucks, and what he did is have them run up and down this road. So the Germans thought there was a lot of GIs out there. There was nobody out there. There was some French, and we had a British anti-aircraft, and there was two anti-aircraft guns. That was it. So they kept driving every night with lights on. See, nobody right. has lights on, but we had to show the Germans.
Sounds like Gideon and his torches, huh?
It's a different kind of war at that time. Our planes would go up, strafe roads, and all kinds of locomotives and all that thing. But yet they would fight the 109s, their headquarters. They were one of the cities. They were in charge of their German planes. And they would go to the town and try to put a bomb down the chimney and explode their headquarters. And they did that. I mean, it was a crazy war then. One, the Germans were here, the Americans there. We would fly, do as much damage as we could. They would fly, especially at night. They would come over there. They had bombers. We didn't. We just had B-40s. Then we got some help. We have A-20s. They had bombs on there, and so did we. But
when you had malaria and you got a 105-degree temperature, was that scarier than getting shot at?
Shot at. That was worse, the malaria.
You really thought you were going to die?
Oh, yeah. But the Navy came through.
What do you think got you through? I mean, what do you think helped you have the willpower or whatever it took to survive that?
Well, I was 21 then, I believe. And there's another thing in the adventure, really. I mean, this is a war. It's a crazy war. Where we were in Morocco was far away from any war. There were a few Germans who helped the French. That's all. Till we got past Algeria, till we got to Tunisia, and the Germans were coming up, being chased by Montgomery.
You ever feel like that part of the war, North Africa, and even the areas that you ventured into later with Sicily and Italy, that those are kind of overlooked with the focus on Japan and higher up in Europe?
I think so. It was nothing to a lot of people. In fact, you never hear about it now.
What were the conditions like? I mean, because we think of Africa in general, and we think heat. We think of North Africa, we think desert warfare.
Yes. When we were in the desert, there'd be a storm, desert storm. You couldn't put your head out of a car. You'd get burned.
By the blowing sand.
Blowing sand. We had to sleep on the ground all over. We slept on the ground, I think, till we got to Italy. As I said before, there's a crazy war between ME-109s and P-40s.
Well, and from your vantage point as a crew chief and having to check this airplane out every time it would come back from a mission, how often were you dealing with an airplane that had sustained a good amount of damage?
Well, we had people who fixed those things. In fact, once they sent this pilot back to Casablanca where they had supplies for planes, well, he left on a Thursday. He didn't come back till a Monday or Tuesday. Our CEO went out there to greet him. He wanted to put him in jail. Where were you? We need these things. He said, look, they close Friday afternoon. They're not open till Monday. That's what happens, war. The ones in the back, they were having a good time. They had all these girls. They had the whiskey. That's true.
That's not what you were doing?
We were being strafed and bombed almost every day. The Germans, we did the same thing to them. But that's what happened. There were planes shot down by us at the field, by the anti-aircraft. Maybe some of our, I would shoot at them. You know, they come trying to kill me. Once we were being strafed, and I was in a revetment with my plane, and I had a hole about, well, maybe it was 10 blocks away to stay away from the plane, because they always want to get the planes.
Right.
They don't care about us, the planes. So one of the planes in our squadron needed a new engine, so they brought a engine. It's in a big box. These are 12-cylinder engines, big box. This MI pilot wanted to get me because I got to the box and he was coming this way and I ran around the other side. I kept running around so he would strafe me, but he couldn't kill me unless he had a bomb on there. So I had a picnic with him, and I'm lucky because I got there in time.
So this is a German pilot who's got you in his sights and basically chases you around in circles for a long time.
And then he was shut down. Maybe I don't know. It's just that my eyes were closed to praying, believe me. Another time they had the bombers come with the ME-109s. They bombed right near me, and I got into my hole, and about half a block away, the bomb, it was a 500-pound bomb, and I went out of it like this. I mean, I was lifted out of that hole, but that's as close as you got. And other times we would get strafed. They would strafe from a high. They were trying to get, you know, the planes, and we would be away from the plane, get a hole. So it was no picnic.
So you're taking cover in a hole, and a bomb hits a little ways down, and it actually blows you up and out of the hole.
Oh, yeah. Blows you up.
That gets your attention a little bit, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
When you're going through that on a daily basis, we've got bombs falling near you, German pilots are strafing you personally, trying to hit you. What does that do to you? And I mean, I think some people would take that and say, boy, I don't want another day of that. I don't think I'm ever going to make it. And some people say, hey, if I survive today, I'm going to survive the next day. What was it for you?
Well, if I could remember, the first time I was really hit by something is when my pilot was killed. That I couldn't take. He was up with other planes, and when he came back, there were ME-109s above. Our planes were in the sun, and they didn't see him, and they lost him. He was shot down, I was told, and he used his parachute. He was killed coming down in the parachute.
So as he's floating down in the parachute, they actually shot him with their planes.
And I felt terrible. I wouldn't get out of that place I was sleeping in for a couple of days, and I just felt real terrible. The other times, it was part of fighting.
Well, I think that paints a picture for our listeners of how much responsibility you took for the men whose lives depended on you and your work as a crew chief, and that was like a piece of you that died that day, it sounds like.
It was.
So eventually, you were able to function again and get back to work. What do you think happened to help you deal with it?
Well, after that, the Germans were right down on the other side of the Kasserine Pass, and there was word of it. And one day, well, the planes were up, but I saw coming to go past us was a long group of tanks. I think it was the 1st Armored and 2nd Armored Division, and they were going to wipe out the Germans on the other side of the hill. In fact, they stopped, and this general asked me, he says, you know, this is high-class warfare. The general asked me, where's Castery Pass? I mean, I'm telling you, it was, at that time, the war was like the comics. He's asking me where the Castery Pass. He's got a whole column of tanks behind him, and I guess he didn't have a map. I don't know what he had. So I said, right, General, right down there. Then you go up to the pass. It was about 4 days after, I'm not sure, I can't remember, is when we were told to leave the airport. Everybody leave because the Germans are coming through. We all left. We had planes on barrels to fix something. We left everything. I helped burn some fuel so the Germans wouldn't have power. And we went back, and then they ordered us back to the same field, to Taleb. The planes were still up there. However, the American tanks were lined up the side of the road, turned over, smashed, and there were tin cans. We called them tin cans, and that's all they were against these giant tanks the Germans had.
Well, the Allies would eventually prevail there, and Leo wasn't done talking to generals either. When we come back, we'll find out how he ended up on the wrong side of the man known as Old Blood and Guts. The rest of Hometown Heroes straight ahead on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 89-year-old Leo Weil of Fresno. He's been very active in our community, and maybe you know him, but hopefully you're learning a whole lot more about him today. Before the break, I alluded to a run-in Leo had with General George S. Patton in Sicily, but I think he wants to take us back a little earlier than that first.
I have another story before the other one. We're still in Cape Bon Peninsula, is in Tunisia. It's a peninsula that goes right out, sandy beaches all over. The Arabs don't swim in beaches, and the French were there swimming. This was after the, terribly, because the Germans are trying to get out, and they were getting killed, which is good for them. I and another fellow said we want to take a drive all the way up the Bone and come around at the end back to where we were stationed, because we were stationed right near the water when they were flying against the Germans. And we're driving, and up ahead, we see a column, couldn't see what they were, but soldiers, there must have been soldiers coming toward us. So I said, geez, what the hell's going on? So this friend of mine, he was driving, and he said, well, let's pull over, then we'll pass them by. Okay. So we pulled over and sat, and they were coming closer, and then they stopped, and then we see who they are. There are these Italian soldiers. And in front is an officer with a white flag. He's coming to give up. And they all had guns. We got out of our Jeep, and we tried to talk to him. We made ourselves, you know, we can understand what he's saying, that he wants to give up to the Americans. Well, I said, we're American, but we don't take prisoners. You go. And what happened to them, I don't know, because they all marched by us. But that was an incident, too. It was crazy.
So you're trying to go to the beach, and these guys are trying to surrender to you.
They almost did, but we wouldn't take them. So that was an incident on Cape Bon, Tunisia. Then we prepared. They sent us northern Algeria, get prepared to invade Sicily. I think there were three or four landings in Sicily, and one is where we went. They put a runway in, a steel runway. The engineers were getting smart now. Now they had a runway. You know, you don't wait for the rain, or the rain comes, you still have a runway. And our planes were going to do their job, and there's a road, and you know how the roads are on the side, it's a built-up road, and on the side there's grass. The mechanics, Walt Crucci's, came, and we sat together, and we're leaning on the side of the road in our coveralls. That's our uniform. And all of a sudden, we hear cars stop. They're halted. The cars just came to a halt. This man in uniform says, you guys get up and stand on the side of the road at attention. Ooh, I never heard that before. Anyway, we did. We got out, and we all stood facing the road, and this big car is there, and this man jumps out with his pearl guns on his hip, and he starts raving. He's a general, and he started raving at us. We're a bunch of mechanics, and we look at the guy. He's crazy. What is he doing here? And he starts telling you, you're undressed. You're not in uniform. What kind of American soldiers are you? I mean, things like that. Well, we said, that's our uniform. We wear overalls. We're mechanics. I don't care what you do. He turns to this captain who called us to get up. I want every name. I want every outfit, where they belong. We'll show them who knows what they're supposed to wear. We didn't say a word, and he went back to his car. Anyway, the captain says, okay, guys, I know what you're thinking. Just forget it. Walk away quietly because we're not gone yet. We have to drive by you, and don't say anything, and forget it all. So we just marched out. We laid down and started laughing, and they went by. That was an incident we had with him. I mean, he's the greatest general we ever had, but he was a nut anyway.
And were you familiar with him at the time? Had you heard stories about Patton, or you just figured it out later, oh, that's who that was?
Oh, we knew it was him. Oh, perfect. He had pearl guns on. Nobody had pearl guns. They had, you know.
Was he wearing the jodhpurs too?
Yeah, he was all dressed up. Mm-hmm. He was perfect. If I was to inspect him, he gets this big star. Really. I mean, he's sitting in that big vehicle, and next to him, all the guys that say yes and yes to him.
So when you hear stories about the gruffness of General Patton or the our blood, his guts, and stuff like that.
We didn't mind, really. We knew he was a little off-centered. But, you know, we waited till the European, where he went through with his tanks. I mean, he was great. We knew that, but we knew he was a little off. However, Sicily, we had a drive in trucks to the areas in the on the coast, northern closest to Italy, and that was the big one, Salerno. And Salerno was invaded by Americans. We landed there D plus 7. D is landing. 7 is 7 days after. And before we got there on the beach, and they gathered us around, they said, listen, guys, if they come and push you back, there's only two things you can do. You can drown in the ocean because nobody's going to take you off, or give up. And you don't want to give up.
That sounds encouraging.
Well, let me tell you, that was rough. They were bombing our ships in the harbor. One munition ship blew up just where I was. And you ask me if it explodes, you feel it? Yeah, a whole ship full of ammunitions went up near us in the water. So it's tough. They're always strafing where you are. We're living in holes. They would come through and shell the beach almost every night, you know? So we're thinking of that. What did they tell us about leaving? Either you drown or you... Because the ships came in and they had to leave because they were bombing us. They were bombing ships, too.
So you're stuck on the beach for a while with nowhere to go.
Right. Salerno. And finally, we pushed them back from Salerno. We watched all of the English troops coming up from the boot past where we were, and getting into fighting the Germans. They're all not British. All the troops that they have from different countries. Mm-hmm. They had Australians, they had New Zealand, they had all these different African troops. In fact, there was one Israeli. They were called the Water Boys. You mentioned the 442 came, and they parked right next to where we were. So we used to see them almost every night because they had guys from Hawaii. Some of the singers, I can't remember their names, who all joined to make Americans know that they're really Americans. They're not a foreigner, even though they look like Japanese.
Yeah, you're talking about the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, which was made up of Japanese Americans, many of whom had families back here who were in internment camps at the time. And when you saw that, did that mean something to you to know that, here, these people, they probably were in a camp themselves, their families are still in camps, and they're over here fighting with us?
I realized it, and I felt very bad for them. They would send them up to the front, and they'd come back, and we knew a lot of them because they were there for some time. And we would talk about it, and they'd say, well, this guy, he was killed, and that guy was wounded. You know, they'd tell us what happened, but they were so proud. to have people who were wounded and all, and even killed, to show that they were real Americans. And they were. After Rome was captured, my outfit was there at their airport, and then they were told that they'll have to go to China. So they were given P-38s instead of P-4. P-38s flew anyway. You know, they could fly up and not go like this. And they stayed in China and Burma till the end of the war, but I wasn't with them because I had come back to Sardinia with this other outfit, the dive bombers, B-47s. And I was there a little time, and then word came from this colonel that was in our outfit that stayed in Tunisia. He said, "Leo, I have a good deal for you." I said, "What?" He said, "They're recruiting crew chiefs from our area because everything is quiet now." He said, "Would you like to go for the B-29 deals?" I said, "Sure, I want to go home. I don't know this new outfit I'm with. They don't know me. And I've had 2 years here. I want to get home." We got to the States, and I had a 30-day leave to see my folks. And then they closed, the Air Force closed the Women's Air Force that were in Sweetwater, Texas.
Mm-hmm. The WASPs.
The WASPs. Mm-hmm. And they did away with it. They didn't need them anymore. So they sent me there to be the chief tech inspector. So I had a vacation, and I had a lot of points. So when I was ready to go, they typed the orders for me to go to Fort Dix, and the colonel of the field, he called me in. He says, "Lyle," he says, "look, you got a good reputation. You're only a staff sergeant, but if you continue with us, I'll make you tech right away, and you'll end up as a God knows what. Just stick with us, young man." He was a Texan. Mm-hmm. I say, "Thank you very much, sir. I'm leaving." And I came home, and I saw the end of the Japanese war as a civilian. I saw it in Times Square, New York.
That was the place to be in August of 1945, from what I understand, Times Square.
But I enjoyed that. Anyway, that's the story.
Well, paint a picture of that for us, because, I mean, we've seen pictures. We've seen the famous photo of the nameless sailor kissing the nameless nurse, and a lot of people have claimed to be both. I don't think you're going to make any of those claims on either. But what was that like, celebrating VJ Day in Times Square?
The end of the war, very happy. And people started to talk to me about the bombs that we blew up, the Japanese, how terrible. I said, "I'm here." They expected 2 million Americans to die in the invasion of Japanese. I says, "I'm here, buddy. Tell somebody else that, not me."
When you think back on it now, what are you most proud of in terms of what you did in the war and what you saw?
I'm proud of being in the war and helping the United States win a war, which was a war that was honest and true, and it should have been done.
I'm curious. I mean, I've interviewed other people that can say this, but as a Jewish American in the military, did you have any understanding of what was going on in Europe and what Hitler was up to? And how did that impact you once you found that out?
I knew before that. I knew that from people who were there, who were coming in and going to Africa and every place to try to get away. So nobody was ignorant of it. But those who wanted to be ignorant of it were ignorant of it. And they used to tell Roosevelt, "Oh boy, everything is fine over there." I knew differently. That's why I joined, and I joined before the war.
Knowing what was going on and how the Jews were being treated in Europe was part of why you joined the service to begin with.
Yeah, treated. They were killed. Mm-hmm. They were massacred. And we have friends who had freed camps. They knew what was going on. I don't know. People want to deny it. How can you deny history?
Does that give you any more satisfaction knowing that you were part of the effort that eventually put an end to that, even though you can't get those 6 million lives back, that by doing what you all did, you brought that to a close?
I think so. You know, I belong to the all the branches, you know, the servicemen outfits, but I also belong to the Jewish Veterans Organization, and they have a book of how many people were in the service and all. You know, there were 500,000 Jews in World War II in the service. Very few people know that. They think Jews don't fight. In fact, when I saw the Jews come up, the water carriers, for the British coming up the boot, I went out to talk to them. In fact, I'm sure I talked to most of the people who became prime minister, or the generals. And they finally allowed them to fight. And they did fight. They were a very good fight. In fact, they're good fighters. Look what they did to the Arabs with millions against them. But I knew, and I felt that way. I still feel that way. We serve. They may be all liberals, but we serve.
Had to get that in there, huh?
Yeah, well, they are.
But clearly you are not.
No.
Did you feel like your experience in the military, whether it was being an airplane mechanic or the combat that you saw, but your experience in totality, did you feel like it prepared you for things you did later on in life?
I think so, yes. Listen, I only had a high school education. When I got out, I could have gone to college. I didn't do it. Of course, today you have to be a college graduate from Harvard or something. I made my way in the world. I worked hard. I did well in Fresno, and I'm not sorry for anything.
And you had some excitement recently in Sacramento, where you went up and were surprised to know that you're the Veteran of the Year for the 29th Assembly District.
I was really surprised.
What did it make you think of when you were up there receiving that honor? Did you think of guys you served with? Did you think back to all those years ago, or what was that like?
I had a lot of friends that I served with, but I'm the only one left in the outfit I was in. But I feel good. I've got a wonderful family. I've got grandchildren, 4 grandchildren. We have a wonderful life.
And your 4 children, your 4 grandchildren, never would have been here if you didn't make it back from the war.
Absolutely right.
And you never would have met your wife of 64 years.
That's right.
What's the secret?
I know the secret, but I'm afraid you'll leave it on your tape. I tell people, if you want to be married a long time, argue. It's okay. You can argue. But the next day, you're good friends again. Don't take it with you, and you'll last together. Because you get married because you love somebody. What's the use of you have a little argument and you quit? It's ridiculous. That's what I tell them.
Well, I'm going to mark that down. I'll share it with my wife, which may start an argument tonight, but that's okay.
Right. Tomorrow's another day.
Mentioned your 4 children and grandchildren, none of whom were alive for World War II or experienced any of it firsthand. When you think about what you want them to understand about that time in our history and what you and the guys like you did and why you did it, how would you express that?
Well, first of all, I want to tell you that one of my grandsons is in the Israeli army today. He wanted to do it, and it took him time to get his parents to agree. But he's very proud of what he's doing, and that's what I was. I was very proud, and my family was very proud.
For good reason. Well, we're out of time on the show today, but Leo, thank you for serving our country. For you at home, thanks for listening, and remember to visit KMJNow.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and more information about Leo and all our guests. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.